Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and each week we scour the internet looking for interesting books, and this week I'm very happy to say we have Waitman Bourne on the show, and we'll be talking about his book, Marching into Darkness, The Wehrmacht and the Holocaust in Belarus. As I was telling Waitman in the pre-interview, I have studied the Holocaust in the Soviet Union for about 20 years now, and one of the things I can tell you is that our picture of it is much more detailed, and also some of the fundamental questions that we were asking 20 years ago now have new answers. And I would say that Waitman has contributed to that revision of what we thought we knew 20, 25 years ago, and we will get to that in due time. But I have to say this is a very enlightening book. Some parts of it are quite disturbing, obviously, given the topic. But Waitman's done a terrific job of explaining really what the Wehrmacht had to do with this aspect of the Holocaust. And so it definitely bears reading if you are interested in the topic. So, Waitman, let me congratulate you on the book and welcome you to the show.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me. I'm really
Absolutely.
Excited to be here.
Yeah, well, it's my pleasure. So could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm from Virginia. I went undergraduate to the United States Military Academy at West Point, and I served in the Army for 5 years after that as a cavalry officer. Got out of that in 2005 and went to graduate school at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, where I was most fortunate to have Chris Browning as my advisor, which is a very rare treat for an academic. And it was there that I started working on this book. I've always been interested in history. My family, as I always say, is sort of, we're the ones that go to the museum and read everything on the wall and spend, you know, hours there. My father, my mom, both interested in that. So I sort of grew up living in the world of history, and it's something that I've been very much excited about. And so when I got out of the Army, I decided, you know, I wanted to do history. I wanted to be an academic. And that's sort of how I got into being a professional historian. And I finished at Chapel Hill, and I had a visiting position at Loyola University in New Orleans. And then I was very, very fortunate to have the first Lewis and Francis Blumkin Professor of Holocaust Genocide Studies and Assistant Professor of History, so it's kind of a bizarre position in that sense, at the University of Nebraska in Omaha here. And so I'm really excited to be able to be working on my topic and genocide in a larger sense, and also with all the outreach and community work there. So that's sort of the short bio of where I'm coming from.
Mm-hmm. What drew you to German history, and particularly the history of the Holocaust, and even more particularly the role of the German army in the Holocaust?
Well, I think I would certainly credit my parents with my interest in the Holocaust. When my father was in Germany in the late 60s, early 70s with the army, and one of the first things he would do with anybody that came to visit him was take them to Dachau. He thought that any American visiting Germany should go to Dachau first, to sort of see the other side of a very beautiful and wonderful country. And so I remember going there when I was very young, when my parents went back and took me to Europe. In a more specific sense, when I was doing my undergraduate work, I was taking a class in Imperial and Nazi Germany, and I had to write a paper. And I wasn't really sure what topic I wanted to write on, and my father sent me an article. He's a doctor, and he sent me an article from the Journal of the American Medical Association on the euthanasia program, the T4, and, the killing program there in Nazi Germany. And I was really fascinated by this. You know, the fundamental question sort of appears as how does a group of people whose first dictum really is to do no wrong end up becoming involved essentially in murdering those under their care? And so that turned into my senior thesis, which is what I was working on there. And I went to the Holocaust Museum as undergraduate, which was fantastic, to do some research there in the archives. But when I got to graduate school and I met with my advisor, as a good advisor does, he sort of asked me the question, well, what is it that interests you in the Holocaust in general, not necessarily a specific area? And for me, really, it's trying to understand how it is that relatively normal people become involved in this sort of thing. Because my position, not surprisingly, I suppose, is that most people who get involved in genocide are not sort of mentally ill in that sense. They're not sociopaths. There's been a lot of very fantastic scholarship done on the T4 program and on the eugenics program, but there's been less work done on the army, on the Wehrmacht, in the Holocaust, particularly at the level that I want to look at. And my advisor suggested, and I think it's a great suggestion, that given my personal background, that I might be able to lend some insight into that. And then I was fortunate enough, we can talk about this later, I guess, to stumble across several related cases in the archives that led me into Belarus.
So talk to us a little bit about the historiography of this question from roughly even during the war to the point at which you pick up the trail. What did, I always say, right-thinking people, because these are people who are opinion makers, think about the participation of the Wehrmacht in the Holocaust prior to really the advent of perpetrator studies?
Well, I think one of the places to start, that's a great question, I think one of the places to start is Nuremberg. At the Nuremberg Tribunal, the SS was deemed to be a criminal organization writ large. So therefore, membership in that organization, no matter really what you did, could term you as a criminal. The Wehrmacht escaped this. The leadership was tried, but as an organization, it sort of wasn't tarred with that same brush. This makes sense from a certain perspective, because if you think about somewhere in the neighborhood of 17 million Germans served in the army at some point or in the armed forces. I use the Wehrmacht as sort of a shorthand for the army in this sense, but really that also includes the Luftwaffe and potentially the Kriegsmarine if you want to look at it that way. But in any case, that's a large number of people. That's a lot of fathers, brothers, uncles, sons, and to sort of paint them with the Holocaust brush, the Nazi brush, would be to make a lot of Germans very, very uncomfortable. So even in the very beginning, there was sort of an unwillingness to turn this prism, turn this gaze on the Wehrmacht. Then we can add in a couple other factors. One is that the Cold War starts up, which makes Germany, of course, a very important ally, or at least West Germany, an important ally for the United States. And continuing to sort of poke away at the army was not something that would endear us to the German government and to the German people. So that was one sort of reason to sort of not follow this lead. In addition, we needed, in a sense, the expertise of many of these high-level guys, the generals, who had fought the Red Army, because that was now on our radar as the new enemy. And so we allowed many of them to come over to the United States and tell us what they had learned fighting the Red Army, which led to many different memoirs. One that I always like to point out is von Manstein's Lost Victories, which the title itself sort of explains the tenor of these memoirs, which tended to be all about what I like to call guns and trumpets and who's taking what hill when and tactics and that kind of thing. And remaining cognizantly and consciously aloof from any of sort of the dirty details of Nazi genocidal policy in the East. And so in that sense, we get a very cleansed and sterile view of what the army does. You know, the army fights the Red Army. It fights against often impossible odds. And so there is in the United States, even today, I think there's a sort of bizarre admiration for the Wehrmacht. In a sense, a sort of last stand against impossible numbers, and they fought very well in that sense. And so that leads to sort of a warped view, I think, of the Wehrmacht. And then from a judicial perspective, very few officials in the Wehrmacht, very few officers and men are tried, particularly after 1949 when the German government takes over those prosecutions. And so there develops this sort of what's called the myth of the clean Wehrmacht, which is this idea that the German army was a sort of apolitical institution whose job was to defend the country and fight against a very real enemy in the Red Army and defend, you know, the homeland from the ravages of the Red Army. And this was, of course, supported in a certain sense unintentionally by the behavior of the Red Army when it invades Germany and participates in a mass rape of German women. And so those who want to take this position in the clean Wehrmacht and say, see, look, the German army was sort of saving us from all of this. And this intentionally overlooks lots of other ways in which the German army was a willing sort of participant in the Nazi genocidal project. And just to bring us up to sort of the more modern period, there are a couple sort of events that raise awareness, I guess, is the way to put it. And one of the most important is the Wehrmacht exhibition, which took place beginning in 1995. And it was a traveling exhibition that went around Germany and Austria. And the goal of it was to show the ways in which ordinary German soldiers and the German army itself were knowledgeable about and complicit in the Holocaust and other sort of war crimes and atrocities on the Eastern Front. And this exhibition is really for the German people, for the public, was really the first confrontation with this topic. I mean, scholars have been working on this, particularly at the upper levels, looking at generals and this kind of thing for a while, beginning even with Raoul Hilberg and some other folks. But for the public, this was really the first time that it was sort of put in their face. And as a result of this, a lot of the documentation that was chosen for the exhibition was intentionally inflammatory. It was cherry-picked to show, you know, and it's all true. I mean, this isn't a fabrication, but it was chosen to show sort of the worst of the worst. And so it generated a lot of heat, perhaps, but not a whole lot of light sometimes. And then it suffered from very, very, very small errors of attribution. 3 or 4 photographs out of thousands were misattributed to the German army when they were, in fact, Ukrainian militia, and so it had to be redesigned and then reopened. But that was the first real sort of exposure the Germans had. But I think even now there is a certain reticence to examine what these men may have experienced during the war.
One question I had while I was reading the book was – and you do mention this, it concerns the treatment of Soviet POWs. Even if you take the Holocaust out of the question, that is the murder of Jews and gypsies and so on and so forth, the genocidal campaign. Mm-hmm. As far as I know, everybody knew that the Wehrmacht, once they had control of these hundreds of thousands, millions of Soviet soldiers, starved them to death. And I don't know how this was avoided in the prosecution of people in the Wehrmacht. I don't understand why there weren't trials or why the Soviets didn't stand up and say, no, the Wehrmacht is a criminal organization. Because, I mean, it was really just totally well documented. There were lots of people that would say, yeah, sure, we captured 600,000 Soviet troops around Smolensk and 200,000 came away.
Yeah, I think that's a great question and a probing question. There probably are a couple of reasons. And I think this applies in a certain sense to the Holocaust itself in the Soviet Union. There was a certain reticence in the West to really recognize or study that topic because, you know, we were anti-Soviet. We were, mm-hmm. that would lend, you know, some sort of sympathy to the Soviet Union, you know, in the sense that they recognized their suffering, which in a certain empirical sense was greater than anybody else in Europe during the war. As far as the POWs go, I think, of course, the army's line is we just took all these prisoners and we weren't prepared to handle them. And so it was sort of this regrettable incident of war, you know, the fog of war. But of course, that's not true. They planned to have no plan.
Yeah, one Kesselschlacht after another. I mean, that was in the plan, right? I mean, they were going to encircle all these people and they were going to take them and then they were going to starve them to death.
Yes, I mean, and even more specifically, they had plans for how are we going to deal with the POWs. And these plans said things like, you know, they were only going to be allowed to eat horse flesh, and they can only use captured Russian medical supplies. You know, there's a memo from one of the army commanders refusing to allow his rail cars to be used to transport to the POWs because it made them dirty, you know, things like this. So, it was a very conscious decision. And then there's, of course, Hitler's famous comment, "Kein Kameraden," that these are not sort of fellow warriors that once you capture them, you can sort of relate to each other. Uh-huh. They've sort of forever been tarred with the brush of Bolshevism, which I think gets to another larger point that I like to sort of highlight, or I think my book highlights in a certain sense, which is this idea of a Nazi genocidal project in which the Holocaust figures prominently, but, you know, the Soviet POWs fall into that, the Soviet people fall into that, mm-hmm. Slavs fall into that. You know, this is the Nazis planned a sort of massive project of demographic engineering in the East.
And so then if we could go on from the POWs, there's also even before the POWs, there's the famous Kommissarbefehl, you know, this thing about shooting basically anybody with a red star in their chest. I mean, I don't know how – I guess what I'm driving at here is that the defenders of the Wehrmacht, even before the exhibition and before your fantastic research, just didn't have a leg to stand on.
No, I think that's true. And I think, you know, in some sense, I think the Soviets took care of that with the people that they caught. I mean, you know, the massive numbers of German soldiers that end up in captivity until, you know, the latest sort of 1955. It is an interesting question, and I don't necessarily know the answer why they didn't push harder. Of course, the Russians at Nuremberg just wanted to execute everybody.
Yeah.
And the Kommissarbefehl is a great sort of lead-in to some of these to this setup, this preparation for Barbarossa. And one of the other orders in there that's even more shocking to me is sort of the guidelines for the behavior of the troops, which basically says for all crimes that you would be prosecuted for elsewhere in Europe,
right,
that you will not be prosecuted for in the Soviet Union. I mean, essentially, this is a, you know, do whatever you want. It's a carte blanche to behave however you want to, as long as your behavior doesn't sort of detract from the military mission or contribute or destroy sort of good order and discipline, which I think is a really key aspect of mm-hmm. the mentality that goes into Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And this goes toward the thesis about – it's Omar Bartov's thesis about barbarization. We'll talk about it in a little while, but, you know, I was always a little bit skeptical of it because it seems to suggest that certain conditions give rise to certain actions, and I guess they do in a rough sense, but we've seen those conditions in a lot of places and they didn't give rise to mass murder. It definitely was the case that something prompted soldiers of the Wehrmacht to participate in atrocities and mass murder. I'm not sure it was barbarization, but we can talk about that in a little while. So I want to begin the discussion of actual Wehrmacht complicity in a place where you don't begin. I think you don't begin, I'm sorry to say, actually in Poland in September 1939. Is it the case, and I think it is the case, that there we have found cases of Wehrmacht units committing atrocities in the Polish campaign in 39? Is that right?
Yes, there are some. One of the most famous is in Częstochowa, which is actually very well documented in photographs. And they are doing this. This also sort of goes back. Isabel Hall wrote a great book, Absolute Destruction, I think so it's called, where she shows that the German army has a long sort of institutional history of violence against civilians. They have this ideal in their head that occupied territories will be perfectly calm. And when they're not, as they never will be, they overreact, and civilians are often the target of this.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, this happens in World War I, and has only recently sort of gotten the attention it deserves because a lot of it was overblown as Allied propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
In Poland, I think, you know, certainly there were atrocities. Some of them are related to, you know, shots being fired and then rounding up the Jews and shooting them as a result.
Mm-hmm.
you know, these very flimsy, you know, certainly not legal reasons, but things like that. One of the things that, one of the experiences in Poland, I think, that's most important, particularly in the context of the book, is that there are a couple generals, General Blaskowitz is one of the most important, who really complain in a very real sense about what the Einsatzgruppen, and of course the Einsatzgruppen are, have an iteration in Poland as well, and he actually complains pretty vociferously about these atrocities that are going on, and of course this ends his career very quickly. But I think why it's important as we move forward is the Nazi authorities, the SS, have decided to discover that they really need to coordinate better with the army. They need to let the army know what they're going to be doing and sort of how they're going to be related and who's supporting who, and set this down all beforehand so they don't have these sort of unfortunate disagreements where certain members of the German army, of course, this still is not the majority, but there were a few who said, you know, look, this is out of line. At the very least, this is just out of line from a sort of civility laws of war sort of standpoint. And I think that's a really important precursor to this. And there have already been some great historians. Alex Rosina wrote a book, and I think, I'm forgetting, Joachim Bohler also wrote a book about Poland as a precursor to sort of Barbarossa and to the Holocaust, which lay out in many ways lots of the crimes that they've committed. I might also point out, before we move on, an interesting piece. There's a book by Raphael Scheck, Hitler's African Victims, where he shows that the Wehrmacht in 1940 in France treated French black colonial soldiers differently than everybody else. In other words, executed them, which is another sort of racialized treatment of POWs that I think is telling.
So that's the first case I wanted to talk about. The second case, and I really like this in your book, is, and maybe I'm making too much of it, but I think you suggest that this notion that, or it's a pretext, I don't know what to call it, that mass murder could really be hidden under the rubric of anti-partisan activity was sort of worked out in the Balkans before they invaded the Soviet Union. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think Serbia is a great sort of example for both comparison and contrast. To give sort of a brief overview, unlike, as we probably talk about in a little bit, or at least as I argue in the period that I work on in the book, unlike in Belarus, Serbia had a very real sort of partisan movement, Serbia, Croatia, Slovakia, that area, mainly communists, but a very active sort of insurgency was going on. And the German army's response, as it always has been, was sort of reprisals and hostage taking and this sort of thing. And of course, they choose Jews as sort of a ready population to draw their hostages from, which is not a particularly utilitarian motive, because the Jews, by and large, weren't the ones who were being the partisans. So by killing them, they weren't really hurting the partisans in any sense. But that would be the, you know, that would be the modus operandi, would be that a German soldier or unit would be ambushed, and they would round up the usual suspects, which in this case meant the Jews, and execute them. There is a this is with scare quotes, but there's a great series of photographs of a Wehrmacht signal unit, so like a communications company, executing Jews as part of this reprisal policy. One of the things that's interesting about it, if you want to look at sort of the higher level condoning of this, I think the original guideline was between 50 and 100 Jews or hostages were to be shot for every German soldier. And Chris Browning has shown this and some other folks, that the officers who chose the higher percentage or the higher number were the ones that got promoted, and the ones that sort of just went with the party line were the ones that got shunted off someplace else. And so I think it's an important precursor, and it'd be nice to find some more textual sort of experiences or you know, transfers of personnel that might have transmitted that knowledge. I haven't found that, which is not certainly not to say that doesn't exist.
Right, right. So that's interesting in the Balkans, because there we see a false equivalency, but an equivalency nonetheless, between Jews and partisans. And then after June 22nd, 1941, we add a third thing, and that is all partisans are Jews, or no, all Jews are partisans, and all Jews are also Bolsheviks. And that's right. It's really when those things come together. And this wasn't unique, I should say, to the Germans. I've read a book recently that a lot of Poles believe this as well, that in fact Jews were all Bolsheviks and were they were partisans for the Red Army after the Germans had come across.
Absolutely.
Germany. Yeah.
And this is a trope that precedes the Nazis. Ever since there was communism, the Jews have often been sort of painted as that's their sort of natural political bent. Of course, for the Nazis, they're also capitalists, so they sort of play both sides.
Yeah, no, that's it's completely incoherent. But
it makes no sense. But it has this small kernel of apparent truth, which is that there were, and you know this, you know, better than I as a Russianist, there were prominent members of the communist leadership who could be termed Jewish. They wouldn't consider themselves to be Jewish, but they could be termed Jewish. And so, of course, you know, the minor 1% proves the rule for the Nazis, that therefore mm-hmm. Jews are behind communism, behind Bolshevism, as a way, you know, as a way to sort of feed off of the countries that they're involved in. And one of the things that I think is really important with this, and I don't want to oversell the connection between the Jews and the partisans, but I think this is one way for the Nazis to make their propaganda and their anti-Semitic policies a little bit more palatable to people who may not be as motivated to participate in anti-Jewish actions, because I think we can agree that most Germans and probably most German soldiers had a very real fear and antipathy towards Bolsheviks and towards communism after the end of World War I and all the upheaval that caused. Mm-hmm. And so if you can try to meld these, and this is kind of what I argue, if you can meld these categories together, so first you say that all Jews are Bolsheviks, or all Bolsheviks are Jews, either way, or all Jews are Bolsheviks, excuse me. That's a relatively easy sell, and it plays into a long history of propaganda that and anti-Semitism that, as you rightly point out, is not unique to Germany or Poland or France, and this is a European sort of phenomenon. If you can do that, and then of course all Bolsheviks are partisans, that makes perfect sense. Then if you can then sort of make this this leap of logic to say that therefore all Jews are either partisans or partisan supporters, which is one of these ways that the Nazis use this great euphemistic language, then you have essentially militarized an entire ethnic group by scare quotes, a legitimate military target, which I think is important for some people because it helps them perhaps rationalize what they're doing. As Gerhard Weinberg pointed out to me once, you know, of course, when they're shooting children and shooting pregnant women, they can't truly believe, most of them probably, that they're partisans. You know, at some point they're forced to recognize this, but the mind is capable of doing lots of gymnastics to try to alleviate this kind of, you know, trauma. And I think that the anti-partisan argument was one way for German soldiers to do that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, in materials that were created by the Wehrmacht prior to June 22nd, is there anything that we find that is, I don't want to use the word smoking gun, but smoking gun, is there anything there that says, okay, we want you to go hunt down Jews under the pretext of anti-partisan activities?
Well, one of the documents, not as specific as such as the way you phrased it, but one of the documents that's issued in the guidelines for the Order of the Troops, it says something to the effect that ruthless action must be taken against Bolshevik agitators, saboteurs, snipers, and Jews. When I'm teaching this, you know, I always point out that one of these things is not like the other.
That's you what know, I was going to say too.
These three things are behaviors, and then one is a group of people. And certainly, there's also there's a sort of comment in there. Remember what it was like in 1918, what communism brought you, and the Jews are constantly conflated with communism. So there's sort of soldiers, I think, would have recognized to a certain extent the blaming that goes on there.
Uh-huh.
And the Germans already are very concerned about this partisan possibility. And this is something that I can touch on for a little bit,
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
I think it's important. You know, we have this image. I had this image before I started this research of defiance, right? The Bielski brothers, and the Germans being afraid to drive around town, around the countryside, because they would, you know, be attacked by these partisans in the snow and gunned down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they totally lost control. And this is, at least I would argue from what I've seen so far, this doesn't take place until much, much later. Essentially, this takes place after the period that I'm talking about in the book. In the period of 1941 and 1942, up until maybe the summer or fall of 1942, there really isn't a partisan movement mm-hmm. as such, for a couple of reasons. One is that Stalin never thought that he would have to surrender ground to anybody, so therefore there was no need to learn how to do this. And I should point out that the Russians have a great history of being quite good at mm-hmm. insurgent warfare, all the way back to the Cossacks. But he also killed off anybody that knew how to do this during the purges, because this is not a skill that Stalin really wanted people to have domestically, you know, mm-hmm. this ability to sort of lead an insurgency.
Mm-hmm.
So the Soviets weren't really prepared from a sort of bureaucratic perspective. And then, you know, the Germans seized so much ground so quickly that there was very little time to sort of set anything up beforehand. So what you have left are small groups of NKVD who parachute in and try to start this. You know, Stalin calls for this in July already. And Hitler uses this as a great example, a great reason to say, okay, now we can take all the gloves off, because Stalin has called on the Russian people to rise up.
Mm-hmm.
But for all intents and purposes, you have these small groups of NKVD, these destruction battalions, which are another small group that were designed to go around and blow up bridges and such. And then large numbers of Soviet soldiers who didn't get caught up in the Kesselschlachts, or who had escaped, and many of whom were trying to either just go home. Many took off their uniforms and tried to go home. Many were trying to get back to Soviet lines. And then a small few were sort of setting themselves up to do some sort of insurgent warfare. But the Germans are preparing essentially for a partisan warfare that doesn't exist at the time, I would argue. Or they're preparing for a partisan war that they sort of create mm-hmm. by their own actions.
Mm-hmm. I see. So let's actually go to the invasion itself. So it's June 22nd, and the Wehrmacht crosses the border. They make very good ground. And these are frontline troops. They make such good ground that they are suddenly given the task of administering or controlling really quite large territories in what is Belarus. And one of the things you point out in the book that I didn't really know anything about is they take, I guess, what I'd call second-line troops or divisions, and they put them in charge of these areas, and they disperse the units around these areas. Can you talk a little bit about how they arranged the occupation of these places? And also, at what point did the military occupation time out, or did it ever?
This is a good question, and it changes over time, because parts of the Soviet Union are earmarked as sort of future colonies of Germany. So you have the Reichskommissariat Ostland, which is the Baltic states, Reichskommissariat Weißruthenien, White Russia, which is essentially Belarus, and then mm-hmm. Reichskommissariat Ukraine. But to get back to the original point of the question, you have these frontline units that go through. And I should be very clear that, you know, in my work, I'm looking at these second line units. I might argue, because most of the frontline units are too busy actually fighting to get involved in some of these aspects. Though I would say that most of the army had an opportunity to be involved in some aspect of the Nazi genocidal project. You've mentioned the Soviet POWs or the Commissar Befehl. I mean, this is also being carried out by frontline mm-hmm. soldiers. There's been some great work done on who's actually doing the Commissar Befehl, because, of course, after the war, the generals say, well, we got the order, you know, and we passed it down, but that was just for show, and we didn't really carry it out. But Felix Romer has done some great work on literally running down the numbers and saying, actually, these guys were killing them. So it's sort of a question of opportunity and location. But in any sense, so you have the frontline area, and then you have what are known as sort of the Army Group rear areas, which are these massive swaths of land until you get to sort of politically appropriated terrain that's been incorporated in some sense into the Third Reich. And it's generally speaking these second line divisions, slightly older. I mean, these aren't, you know, the Landwehr, these aren't the militia, but they're just, you know, they tend to be a little older and a little less experienced. Get tasked with administering these areas as the frontline troops move forward. And on the ground, what this looks like generally is that is what's called an Ortskommandantur, sort of a military government office in these towns and villages, who reports to sort of a higher level civil military government organization. But at the lower level, I mean, these are just the regular officers that are also fulfilling the secondary task of administering Nazi policy in these towns. Mm-hmm. And in August, part of sort of Minsk or sort of Belarus gets split, and then part of it officially falls under the Reichskommissariat Ostland. So part of the units in the book, or part of the actions in the book that I describe, take place under in the Army Group rear areas, and part of them take place later in what's called the Reichskommissariat Ostland, in a sort of political area, all done by German soldiers, but they're under sort of different leadership.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we can move forward now to talk about the very first incident that I think you talk about in detail, and that is at Krupki. Mm-hmm. And can you explain to us what happened there?
So Krupki is a little village. I was fortunate enough to visit it during my research. It's on the main highway from Minsk east. I think it's 60 miles or so east of Minsk. We drove out there to visit. It was a sort of smaller market town, had a large Jewish population of around 1,000 Jews. But as I said, it's on the main logistical supply route east. And that's how the unit that gets involved, the 354th Infantry Regiment, gets involved in this operation because it's stationed there. One day in September, sometime before the 18th, a unit of the Einsatzkommandos, the Einsatzgruppen, these SS mobile killing squads, shows up. The commander shows up, a guy named Werner Schönemann, who is a particularly vile but interesting guy, shows up, and he meets with the commander of this unit, the battalion commander, a guy named Major Waldo. And this is, of course, we can talk sources later, but this is corroborated by a bunch of the soldiers who were questioned after the war who remember this meeting. It's unclear exactly what is said, but he goes into the office, he meets with the guy for a while, and essentially what they're doing here is they're laying out responsibilities during an upcoming action by the Einsatzgruppe, in this case by Einsatzkommando 8, Teil Commando or sort of sub-commando Schönemann, named after this SS man. Schönemann leaves. What's, I think, really interesting and really telling is that a lieutenant from the unit then rides out of the town on a horse with one of his soldiers, and they go and they essentially find the killing site. They scout out the location for the killing site, which is about a half a mile or so north of town in near a swamp in a forested area that was used for harvesting peat. So there were already potentially sort of trenches or some kind of excavations there. But he finds this and goes back and reports this to his leadership. So here already you have a really interesting mode of complicity. One of the things that I really wanted to show in the book was what complicity looks like on the ground. And this is something I think we'll probably talk about. But it's a very vague term, especially when it's applied at the higher levels. So in any case, the next day, this German army unit surrounds the town from the outside to prevent any Jews from fleeing. So in the early morning hours, they go out and they surround the town. And then a separate company goes into the town then and assists in the rounding up of the Jews from their houses. This is something that the soldiers don't often talk about, so it's unclear how deeply they were involved and how much the SS was involved. But when we consider that the Einsatzgruppen just have a real manpower problem, it's likely that the German soldiers are involved in pulling people out of their houses. And this is, in many ways, a very traumatic event for them. And I'm going to use this word traumatic frequently, and I want to be clear that this is not sympathy for the soldiers, but that it is a place in which they are experiencing sort of more stressful emotional contact with the people that they're involved in. And again, this is not to sympathize with them, but one of the reasons they don't talk about this, I think, is because, they are literally involved in dragging elderly and sick people out of their beds, sometimes shooting them in their houses. And this for them is a very close sort of interaction with things that they sort of know are wrong. the Jews are then are rounded up and are guarded in the center of town. So there's sort of a smaller cordon in the center of town on the marketplace where they're guarded by the German army again. The mayor or one of the SS leaders, it's unclear exactly, reads out a list of names, so clearly there was a list of who they were looking for. And then they begin to be marched out of town along the main road to this killing site. Those that can't walk are driven in army trucks, so the army is supplying vehicles for this, and the army is supplying men to walk alongside these Jews and prevent them from escaping. And this is all very well documented. There are men who admit doing this, say this is what I was doing. There's a very poignant moment in one of these testimonies where this German soldier is describing his actions as a guard marching them to the killing site. And he says that a small child's pants fell down around its ankles and it was in danger of being trampled by everybody else because they were pushing them along very quickly. And so he allowed the mother to pull the kid out of line and pull his pants back up. But then he put him back in line and kept on going. You know, so it's a very sort of disturbing moment. Once they got to the killing site, the Jews were forced to sort of, after they gave up their valuables and whatnot to the SS, they were forced to sit in this field, which is still there today, within, if not sight, certainly sound distance of the actual trenches, the killing site, the killing trenches. And they know what's going on. And German soldiers are guarding them there, and the German soldiers finally are also guarding the killing site itself. They've formed a smaller cordon around the trench to prevent anyone from escaping. And then lastly, I should point out sort of the grayest area in the research here, and this is partly due to sources, is that they did participate in the actual shooting itself. And there are a couple ways in which I argue, at least in the Kripke killing, that this happened. The first is there was bad weather approaching. There are a couple factors in this. Bad weather is approaching. Werner Schönemann, the SS man, by all accounts, was very good at what he did, but didn't like it to take a long time. He liked to get it over with as quickly as possible. It's potentially possible that his men were running out of ammunition, and so they sort of roped the nearest German soldiers into doing this as well. That's one explanation. Another explanation is that one of the platoon leaders had actually asked the night before for volunteers for an unpleasant task. And this is a euphemism that's repeated throughout, you know, the Holocaust as well, and that he had received volunteers who did this. And that then this group also was rotated in to shooting these people, you know, at close range into this pit. And then, you know, sort of after this is over, locals from Kripke are forced to cover the pit, and the SS leave with all the valuables, the most of the valuables, and whatever's left over is left over for the local Belarusians, who I should mention here that the some sort of Belarusian police or militia likely also participated in this killing. But essentially, that's sort of the layout of the Kripke killing, which is the sort of first instance that I talk about in the book.
So what does this tell us about complicity at this stage, very early stage, in both your story and the invasion of the Soviet Union?
This is a great question. I think it's very disturbing, and was to me, in a certain sense, surprising the initiative which some of these men displayed. I argue that it's sort of it's kind of like radiation. Exposure builds up over time, and as the exposure builds up over time, the Unions become more complicit. I could mention, and this is probably useful given our earlier conversation, that this unit had been involved in guarding a very large Soviet POW camp in Drozdy, just outside of Minsk, 100,000 men surrounded by one, you know, a strand of barbed wire, which was conveniently placed on the other side of a stream so they couldn't get to water. And this unit had watched the Commissar Befehl being executed. They'd watched people being killed. They'd watched Jews being rounded up out of this camp. They had killed prisoners themselves trying to escape, or who had escaped and been recaught. So there's a certain level of exposure that builds up. On the other hand, for this unit, I think for the men, this was a first. This was something new for them. And that may explain, you know, why there wasn't why there was less sort of resistance and also less of some of the more egregious forms of complicity that I talk about later in the book. Mm-hmm. Because they're just, in a certain sense, overcome by the speed and tempo of these events that they're involved in.
Mm-hmm. Were they offered the opportunity to opt out and do something else?
There wasn't really a moment like the moment in Ordinary Men where Major Trapp sort of says anybody who wants to step out can.
Mm-hmm.
There are some men who say that the platoon leaders, for example, the guy who asks for volunteers is asking for volunteers. So if you don't want to, you don't have to volunteer. And there are men who sort of try to refuse to participate. Many of these examples come from later episodes that we can talk about. But in this instance, there are a few who do this. Most sort of go along and do what they're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, I see. So the next moment in the book, I mean, you call this improvised murder. The next moment in the book, which I found fascinating, is I didn't know anything about this, the Mogilev conference. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is, I think we all as historians are sort of searching for something really new and exciting. And if there's anything in the book that I think might fall into that category, I think it might be Mogilev, which interestingly it's been referenced before by other historians. So it's not totally new in that sense, but I was able to find sort of some more documentation and look into this and then connect it with another case, which I thought was really exciting. Just to give a brief summary of it, in late September, I think the 24th to 26th of September 1941, by the way, this is a little over a week and a half or so after the killing in Kripke, the commander of Army Group Center Rear, which is basically where all of this stuff takes place, calls for a meeting in which he wants German officers with an experience in partisan warfare to come to this conference, share their ideas, you know, sort of brainstorm about how to fight the partisans. Of course, as I've mentioned, the partisan warfare itself is sort of non-existent at this point, so it makes you wonder. But I found the list of attendees. There are attendees from the units that have already been participating in this stuff and who will later be participating in killing themselves. The attendees are overwhelmingly lower-level officers and overwhelmingly Army. One of the important sort of sessions, this is basically, you know, like an academic conference. They have sessions and different people present. And one of the presenters is Arthur Nebbe, who was the commander of Einsatzgruppe B, who was at the time presiding over the murder of the Jews of Belarus. And the title of his presentation was The Jewish Question with Particular Regard to the Anti-Partisan Movement. And so I have the agenda, but I don't have any minutes. So we don't know exactly what he said. But I think we can surmise, given what happens later, that he was interested in trying to get the Army more involved in the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm. And you can infer that from what happens next, correct?
Exactly. And yeah. I want to point out, you know, one of the other things they do at this conference, which is a very typical military sort of thing to do, is they go out and they observe sort of a sample operation, a sample anti-partisan operation, to show sort of this is how you do things. And if you read the diary of the unit that actually carried this out, they say something to the effect of, we didn't find any partisans in the village, we did find X number of Jews, and with the SD, i.e. with the Einsatzgruppe, and we executed a large number of them. And so here they're having, you know, this is sort of the approved solution that's being shown to them. And then after the conference, at least in one of the divisions, and I went through, and this is just based off of their own reporting, the numbers of individuals who are captured and killed sort of skyrocket. And I think this is highly suggestive. But then the last reason, and this is something, again, that I've just been really, really lucky to find, because historians, we rarely find this sort of thing. On October 10th, so a little over 2 weeks after this conference, another battalion farther east gets the order to kill all the Jews in its area. And the three commanders in this battalion each have a different response. One of the commanders, who is reportedly sort of an avowed Nazi, says sure and does it. The second commander sort of hems and haws about it, and he asks for a written confirmation, which he receives, and then he carries it out. But the third commander says no, he won't do it. And in his letter that he wrote to the German court after the war during the case, he says that there was a conference in Mogilev where the topic was Jews and partisans, and that as a result of this conference, that's where this order came from, to kill all the Jews in his area, which is, I mean, we never find stuff like this. You know, so I was really happy to sort of be able to connect that then to the Krucha killing, which we actually have a court case on. And so I had lots of testimony and documentation of it.
Mm-hmm. So are you contending then that the Mogilev conference led to some sort of firm relationship between the SD, that is the Einsatzgruppen, and these rear area Wehrmacht units about the treatment of Jews?
I think so. I mean, like everything else in history and also in the Holocaust, you know, we can sort of very rarely draw the direct line, you know, between these sorts of things. There's a precedent to an oral mode of transmitting sort of Holocaust-related policy. So, for example, Himmler, the shift in killing from simply Jewish men of military age to men, women, and children can sort of be tracked by Himmler's visits and his conversations with the police battalions, for example, and various SS and Einsatzgruppen units. And I would suggest that something happened similar at Mogilev. There's also an executive summary that's published after this conference, which is then distributed to everybody in the Army Group Center rear. And it has sort of a disturbing paraphrase at the end, and I'm going to paraphrase it because I don't have it in front of me, but says something to the effect that, you know, decisions on life and death are difficult for every soldier, but he acts correctly who acts the most ruthlessly and with disregard for his own sort of personal emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I would argue that you don't need to tell this to soldiers that are fighting other soldiers, because when someone's shooting at you, you feel very little sort of need to hem and haw about that. But if you're trying to get them to do something out of their comfort zone, that's important. What I found even more interesting in the very end of the research, I just randomly saw this when I was doing some reading, is that that paragraph was lifted verbatim and then published in another memorandum that was distributed to the order police, these police battalions who were really, really tasked with killing Jews, which I thought was an interesting sort of distribution of knowledge. But I think that that's certainly something that happens, and it becomes even more pronounced in some units. So the 707th in division in Slonim and Novogrodok actually sort of develops a distribution of labor wherein the German army will round up Jews in the countryside, allowing the SS to sort of focus on the larger population centers.
Since you mentioned both of them, could you talk to us about the Slonim massacre and then the Novogrodok massacre? Is that the order in which they occur? Is it the other way around? I can't remember.
No, that's correct. The Slonim is in November 14th.
Okay, then let's start with Slonim.
And Slonim is a much, much larger city and had a very large Jewish population, somewhere in the neighborhood of 25,000 or so. And on November 18th, November 14th, 10,000 of them are shot in one day. The German army unit there, the 6th Company from the 707th, actually dug the pits, which is very interesting. I'd never seen that before. And they participated in the shooting. They participated in all the other modes that I had mentioned before. One of the things that I found sort of very disturbing is they guard the pit at night after the shooting because, as often happens in these shootings in the East, as they go on and people get drunker and drunker, they don't do as well, and there are survivors. And many of the accounts we have from survivors about these killings are from people who literally crawled out of these pits into the forest after the killing. And so these soldiers have to spend the night there surrounding the gravesite. And there's one of these soldiers in his testimony after the war says that he was really scared at one moment because somebody crawled out of the pit next to him, you know, and that was very frightening. Another said that he could hear, you know, voices underneath the bodies. But they were ordered to do this, and so they're guarding this pit. Some of them are robbing the bodies. But what I found most disturbing is afterwards, the next morning, they went off on these patrols, you know, tracking blood trails through the forest like you would if you were a hunter, to find those who had escaped, round them up, bring them back to the pit, and shoot them again, which I thought was sort of very, very damning, because if you can I think you can. I think it's fair to make the argument that there's a certain level of compulsion about being in the military, and so when someone says to go guard the town or do this, there's a certain level of compulsion that's inherent in that. But it'd be very easy to go on one of these patrols and not find anybody.
Yeah.
You know, and just come back and say you didn't find anybody. It's also very easy to not steal. You know, that's certainly not, or no, it was not an order. It was a voluntary action. And then the rapes and sexual exploitation that take place that I talk about as well is certainly not ordered. And I think all of these things together are sort of indicative of an increasingly sort of accepting mindset in the Army at the slower level. I mean, these guys are stealing clothing and sending it to their families in Germany, which is sort of very disturbing. And Novogrudek is a similar kind of killing, a smaller number, somewhere around 5,000, but a similar sort of participation by the Wehrmacht and a similar, you know, deeper level of complicity.
Mm-hmm. I see. So I'm interested in the chain of command here, and I don't recall from the book, I'm sure you say exactly how it ran, but the SD couldn't order Wehrmacht units to do things, could they? I mean, they had to go. I don't understand how exactly the orders went.
Yeah, and this is very complex, and it's still complex for me, and I think that reflects sort of how it was on the ground. Just to give a brief example from Slonim, so Slonim originally is you know part of the rear area, and so the Army has control of it, and the Ortskommandantur, the sort of local military headquarters, is in charge of everything. And so they're in charge of, you know, provisioning, they're in charge of setting up local authorities that will be friendly to the Germans, all of this sort of thing. Then after August, this area becomes part of the Reichskommissariat Weißruthinien, which means it will fall under a Nazi civil administrator, a guy named Gerhard Ehren. And so he shows up with not enough supplies, and half his people get sick and go home before we can even get started. You know, they're not sending the top people to Eastern Europe. But then he and the Army then have overlapping areas of influence, because the Army will always have sort of security as its area of emphasis. But, you know, given what we've talked about already, the sort of anti-Jewish policy falls under this area. So what you have is a very, and then of course you have the Einsatzgruppen who answer to the Reichsführer SS and who answer to the higher SS and police leader for whichever area they're in. And so you have these three separate sort of chains of command that sometimes bring them into conflict, but more often than not, they sort of work it out and end up working together. I didn't find really an example of anybody refusing to participate on sort of bureaucratic orders or saying you don't have the right to tell me what to do. They had this kind of conflict very often because they just didn't like each other. The German civil administrators who end up in Eastern Europe are often very loathsome kinds of people, and the officers very often don't like them, but that never really ends up inhibiting the execution of the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, I see. The last incident, it's not really an incident, it's a practice that you deal with in the book, is the Jew hunts, the so-called Jew hunts. Can you talk a little bit about those? I think those show initiative pure and simple.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the ways that I was trying to conceptualize the book was as a sort of progression that begins with sort of an improvised mode of participation, which I sort of show in the creepy killing, where, you know, they're just kind of flying by the seat of their pants and working it out on their own, and then ends up with sort of what I call an internalization, that the German army, at least the units that I'm studying, internalized that this is policy, and this is what we're going to do, and I don't want to put words in their mouth and say they thought it was right, but that certainly it was allowed, and for those who were interested in killing Jews anyway, it was a carte blanche to do so. And so in the town of Schuchin, which I won't even attempt to spell because it's got multiple C's and V's and Y's in it, but there is a company based there, and they routinely go out on what they call Jew hunts, which would also be called anti-partisan patrols. Of course, they're all riding in a truck, and they pull up in a village and get out, which is not really how you capture partisans.
Yeah.
It's not a very inconspicuous way of doing things. And so they would frequently, as a matter of policy, kill Jews, you know, twos and threes and fours, wherever they find them, come back to the company headquarters, and the clerk himself, company clerk admits this, would report them as partisans killed. Mm-hmm. So you have this sort of body count thing. So they're reporting the Jews as partisans. Mm-hmm. And this is an open secret. Everybody knows who's doing this and why they're doing it, who they're doing it to. And there is sort of a group of usual suspects in the unit who seem to be the company or the platoon that always goes out and does this, mm-hmm. Which I think is also sort of vitally important from a sort of motivation standpoint, because then you can see how that takes the onus off of anybody else for having to confront this decision of should we or should we not participate, because mm-hmm. they're never faced with that because there are always other folks who are willing to do it. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I see. Well, one of the things I appreciated about the end of the book, there are a couple of things, and I'll come to the second in a moment, is that you attempt to address the question of representativeness of these units that you deal with, because you only deal with, and I don't recall exactly how many, but it's 2, 3, or 4. Can you talk a little bit about how representative they were?
Yeah, and this is sort of the big question, the big R. And I remember, you know, vividly as a graduate student, when I would read people's books, I'd always be like, yeah, but is this representative? You know, like, how do we know that this person's, you know, topic, this person's subject is representative of the larger whole? And now I find myself, you know, on the other end of that. And rightly so, because, you know, and people will point out, I suspect, and they'll be right, that, you know, the German army was a huge organization with huge numbers of different types of units, who had a wide variety of experiences. And so I don't think I can ever say that this is representative of every unit in the German army. And there have been great books done on trying to sort of categorize experience based on type of unit and frontline or rear area duty. With that being said, I think my conclusion in terms of representativeness is that there's very little that's extraordinary, demographically or otherwise, about these units. That there was, and I intentionally looked at least 10 or 13 other divisions, other units that were in this area or went through this area at some point, to try to get a feeling for this question, because I myself was concerned that, you know, I don't want to be cherry picking either, you know, the worst case scenario. And what I discovered was that many of these other units were spouting some of the same propaganda and some of the same arguments, and they were following some of the same policies, and that those that ended up being in an occupation duty longer ended up becoming more complicit in anti-Jewish measures almost by natural course. And so I guess I suggest in terms of representativeness that certainly the institutional culture of the German army was such that given the opportunity, they would at least tend to become more complicit rather than less. So in other words, they were prone to participating. And this is, of course, not to say that they were Hitler's willing executioners or that they were all chomping at the bit to do this, but that the institutional culture, the situational mindset, the ideological pressures, all of these things that we sort of bandy about, which was more important, would tend to reinforce behavior that was more complicit than less.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, it seems to me, just given the nature of militaries as what at least one sociologist calls a kind of total organization, where order and regimentation are really the principal moments, that you should find consistency across them. It seems to me the onus is on the people who think it's not representative. You see what I'm saying? Given that every unit is supposed to be like every other,
right?
I think we need to turn the question around. Why wouldn't you think this is representative?
Well, I mean, I think you're right, and I think the study that hasn't been done yet, and I think there are good reasons why it hasn't been done yet, but the study that I think really needs to be done is of the frontline units, and trying these, because this is sort of the argument of the non-representativeness is, well, these aren't the frontline units.
Yeah.
And so if most of the German army is the frontline units, i.e. engaged in what we would call conventional combat, what are they doing? Are they participating or not? I'm not sure that necessarily is the most important question anyway, but it is an important question, and I think we're hampered very much by the sources. you know, one of the reasons why, and I will point out that one of the units that I talk about in the book goes on into the closest thing it'll see to frontline duty, which is these large anti-partisan sweeps in 1942, and carries with it the same awful behavior and sort of murderous attitude that it does, that it had gained earlier. But as far as sort of the documents go, one of the reasons that this book sort of ends when it does in the spring of 42 is that most of the units that I talk about end up having to go to the front.
Yeah, this is the second part that I really liked about the book, is that you didn't leave us wondering what happened to these fellows. And there's a certain poetic justice concerning what happened to them.
Yeah, exactly. And I
they,
like
the, they get all chewed
I like,
up.
I like to point out that, you know, it's a lot harder to shoot people when they're shooting back.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But go ahead and tell us what happened to them, because it's really it tells you something about the Eastern Front, because it's catastrophic.
Yeah, I mean, there's a crisis in December when the German army fails to capture Moscow. There's a crisis, and then begins a series of Soviet winter counteroffensives, and the German army then starts looking back to the rear to salvage whatever, you know, most useful units you have. And in all of these security divisions that I talk about, the most useful units are these second line divisions, these second line infantry regiments, because they are conventional units. You know, they are designed for combat, and they get sent to the front and they get chewed up. I mean, you know, sometimes two or three times over.
But they suffer just absolutely horrendous casualty rates that, you know, to somebody who studied, say, for example, American military history, you just can't really wrap your mind around it.
Yeah, I mean, they're just completely destroyed, and then eventually they're completely destroyed again in 44.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't do the study that would have been
right.
Probably even better, which would have been some kind of longitudinal following them all the way through the war, but they just ceased to exist, and mm-hmm. with them physically, the records ceased to exist.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I suspect that the same thing is true of the frontline units. You know, when you're being destroyed, you have very little time to write down, you know, information about what you're doing, and you're very occupied. So, as far as the representativeness goes, I think there's a study out there that needs to be done about trying to point out or trying to figure out at the front, you know, what are these guys doing with regards to anti-Jewish policy and the
mm-hmm,
Holocaust.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I might suggest that one of the reasons that we don't have as much information is that a lot of the fighting at that point takes place outside the former Pale of Settlement.
Mm-hmm.
And so the demographics change. And so Jews are not as concentrated, they're not as numerous, they're in smaller numbers, and so they wouldn't be as encountered in the same way as they are in the rear areas.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me make my final question this, and it really has to do with what it is to be a historian, I think, and you know, books don't fall out of the sky. People write them, and we know a little bit about your background. You were in the military. How did your own experience and knowledge of the military, what does it make you think about these people? How did it affect your judgment and understanding?
Well, I think one of the disturbing things is how much I recognized in the German Army from my experience in the United States Army. And let me be clear to listeners and everyone that I'm not equating the two. You know, one was a genocidal organ that fought for a racist genocidal regime, and the other is an all-volunteer, you know, ethically grounded force of a democracy. But I mean more in just the sort of nuts and bolts of how militaries operate. You know, you have the sergeants who are angry because the officers never listen to them, you know, and you have the first sergeant, the highest enlisted guy, who all he's ever wanted to be is a first sergeant, and he acts like a little martinet or a little Napoleon. You know, you have the lieutenant who doesn't really want to do anything, and so he sort of bows out. Just some of these dynamics of individual units that I recognize from my own experience, because I think they're universal. I think that the Roman legions probably had some of these same sort of dynamics. And it's interesting. It was interesting to me to sort of see how they played out in something as awful as the Holocaust, and that they, you know, that these things that are sort of innocuous or at least neutral, you know, these sorts of confrontations can have very real effects when applied in sort of a genocidal context, and when applied in the context of an organizational climate that condones violence and condones murder and condones sort of racist behavior. And so I was very cognizant sort of my background and trying to think about, think about this, you know, in terms of relationships between individuals. I think one of the drawbacks of people who study the military, and I consider myself really more of a social historian, and my topic was sort of in the military, but people can tend to view military units as sort of these cohesive blocks. You know, like the company does this, the regiment does this. And my experience was in the military, and I think it's a truism, and I think it's true here, is that the military units have cliques in them just like anything else. And there are groups, you know, that nobody likes. There's the crappy soldiers who don't do their job very well and are lazy. And then there's the go-getters who really want to do the best they can. And then then these groups don't always get along. And then you have the Catholics and the Protestants. And so there are all kinds of different sort of schisms and ways that these units can break down. And that when they're put under the stress of these sorts of situations, they don't behave as sort of this cohesive band of brothers, you know, group of people. They have individual agency. Mm-hmm. And I think one thing that I really was cognizant of trying to portray in the book is that they have choices. They have very, very real choices in what they're doing. And they choose most often to either be ambivalent or be complicit. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think this is if I have something to say to the community of sort of Holocaust scholars in history, I think that's what I'm saying here. I think we let off the hook too many people for sort of this obedience to orders. And I should add at the end here that, you know, I also in the book I'm trying I do try to show that there are those who refuse.
Yeah, you do.
And there are those who help.
Mm-hmm.
Rescue might be too strong a word, though it could be applied in a couple cases. Of course, these people are statistically insignificant. But they're vitally significant, I think, because they give the exception to the rule, and mm-hmm. they show that you can do this, you can refuse to participate, with no negative repercussions, with all intents and purposes. I mean, the negative repercussions are, you know, for example, the captain who refused to carry out the order, it was essentially called a weak individual, words we can imagine, you know, misogynist kind of words, and accused of sort of being a weak individual, but I mean, as long as you can handle that, that's all that he experienced. Many of the others just would say, I don't want to shoot, I don't want to participate, and they would be reassigned someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, what's important also is that few of them refused sort of these ancillary positions, you know, in the guarding and the marching and the rounding up. So that, I think, is important. But I think recognizing that these guys had choices, and that often they chose, from a certain perspective, geographically where they were on the ground, is important to point out, because I think sometimes we look at the military and we say, oh, it's this order-based organization, this obedience-based organization, and we let people a little bit off the hook for doing what was hard but would be right. You know, it's hard to stand up to your peers, but it's the right thing to do, and I think many people might have seen that and just didn't do it. Mm-hmm. I should point out, lastly, you know, one of the examples, and this is something I came across in earlier research, you know, the company commander goes up to his clerk and says, I want you to go out and shoot Jews tomorrow. And he says, you know, no, you've known me for 3 years now. You know I'm not the kind of person that would do this, and I'm not going to do it. And that's where that ended.
Mm-hmm.
And if you draw it out to its logical conclusion, you know, what is the army going to do? Are they going to literally bring charges against a guy who's going to say, I'm sorry, I didn't want to shoot women and children,
mm-hmm.
and go through a court and have that all on the record?
Right.
No, they're not going to do that. So I think the men realized, many of them, that there was room to maneuver themselves. Maybe not to convince others, but there was certainly room to maneuver themselves into positions that they were comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
And this applies to both more exploitation of Jews and to those few who decided to rescue them or to help them. Once they sort of got a feeling for the terrain in which they were operating, they saw the areas in which they could either become more complicit or, in a small number of cases, help or kind of resist.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point about not wanting to proceed in a court-martial or judicial fashion, because you would have to talk about the orders that they refused.
Right, and it becomes a matter of record at that
yeah.
point, you know, and
yeah.
and it's one thing to sort of use your influence and your peer pressure to make someone do something, but it's quite another when you have to sort of lay that out in an argument. I mean, I kind of, this is one of my policies with my students, is that if you have a disagreement with my grading, that I want you to then just write me a half page where you justify, you know, why you think I made a mistake and where you think I would change it.
Right.
And that takes care of a lot of problems, because the students who are like, well, but I should get an A, you can't just write that down, you know, and print it in. And I think something similar sort of applies there.
Yeah. I see what you mean. Well, Waitman, we've taken up a lot of your time, actually more time than I expected that we would. But this topic is fascinating to me, and I bet it's fascinating to our listeners. Let me conclude our interview with our traditional final question, and that is, what are you working on now?
Well, it's a story of sort of one of those things that when you're doing research and you find something interesting and you don't use it. I found this case back in 2007. 2006, about a German maintenance unit that was operating in a camp called Janowska, just outside of Lvov, Lviv or Lemberg, depending on which way you're coming at it. So I went back and looked into that, and my next project is not about the German army, but it's going to be about this Janowska camp. It's a concentration camp. It's a forced labor camp. It's a slave labor camp. And it's also a site of mass killings.
Hmm.
And it's a really fascinating place because I think it has, and there's no major study that's been done on it, and it has a lot to offer us, I think, in terms of relationships between German businesses and the Nazi sort of slave labor regime. It tells us also a lot about different policies and how the Holocaust evolved in that particular region. There's lots of a lot of survivor testimony about it, and I really want to get into that and sort of think about what we can learn. And again, at the local level, because I think that's where we learn the most, and it's where history is most complex. And so I'm going to try to apply that same sort of focus to Janowska.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds fascinating, and I hope you come on the show when you're done with that book.
I'll be happy to.
That'd be great. We've been talking with Waitman Bourne today about his book, Marching into Darkness, The Wehrmacht and the Holocaust in Belarus. Let me say thank you, Waitman, very much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. This has been wonderful.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. And let me tell everyone that I'm Marshall Poe, and I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network. And I want to thank you all very much for listening and wish you a great week.